This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, local emergency experts discuss natural disaster threats facing Utah and how we can best prepare for them. From wildfires to floods to earthquakes, the experts emphasize why preparedness is key to public safety. They also lay out the local, state, and federal resources available to those affected by disasters, and how climate change can increase the frequency and severity of these events. On the panel are John Flint, Emergency Preparedness Coordinator for Salt Lake City, Clint Meekum, Emergency Manager for Salt Lake County, and Jana Wilkinson, Recovery and Mitigation Planner for the Utah Division of Emergency Management. Moderating the discussion is Jeff Gravitt, Director of the University of Utah Emergency Management Services. This forum was recorded on October 16, 2019. Here is moderator Jeff Gravitt.
Again, my name's Jeff Gravitt. I am your Emergency Management Director here at the University of Utah. I've been doing this for about 37 years, so I'm really kind of long in the tooth when it comes to emergency response. I've probably seen and done most of it, so it's good to be with you. One unique thing about me so that you can remember, and I only say it because it's really, really cool. For 37 years, I've been playing golf. I've never had a hole in one, not one time. However, Memorial Day 2019, Davis Park, 171 yard six iron, popped it in the hole on a laser for my first hole in one, right? I mean, that's like winning the Super Bowl. If you're a golfer, you won the Super Bowl if you did that. That gets better. 3 weeks later, Valley View, hole seven, 185 yards, I dunked another one. And if that isn't good enough for you, Labor Day 2019, hole seven at Davis, I canned another one, okay? So if you walk out of here without any other information, know that I've met my mark and I've done what I need to do on this planet, okay? All right, so welcome to today's panel. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. John Flint. John is the Emergency Preparedness Coordinator for Salt Lake City. He's our local expert, if you will. John, I'd like you to take maybe just a couple of minutes. Tell us a little bit about your background and what you do for Salt Lake City.
So a little bit about me. If you can't tell by the way I look, I'm not from here. I'm moved here from the South. Came from Arkansas. Had the good fortune of living right in the intersection of where Hurricane Alley and Tornado Alley meet. That's where I lived. So dealt with a lot of natural disaster throughout the course of my career. Hadn't been at it quite as long as Jeff. My professional career started in 1994. But since I'm 51 and grew up in the South, I've pretty much been doing it for all my life. So my background, I came up through the fire service in Arkansas, firefighter, EMT, on up to the rank of captain during that time. Got into hazardous materials, and then through a unique set of different circumstances, being in the right place at the wrong time, I got drafted into being a contract instructor for chemical and biological weapons through Arkansas Department of Emergency Management for FEMA and DOJ, and then after its creation, DHS. Headed up the Northwest Regional WMD Hazmat Response Team and was a DHS contractor for last 2 years of the Clinton administration, all eight of the Bush administration, and I moved here and thought, and I learned that apparently after moving here, once you're a DHS contractor, you're always a DHS contractor, because I thought I was done with that, and we had a little mishap. Apparently, if you guys, I don't know how many remember, a little deal with the missing anthrax out at Dugway. I got a call from Northcom and said, hey, you're a DHS WMD chemical biological contractor. So I had the good fortune to go out there and help. Oh, by the way, anthrax was not missing. It was just misplaced. So it was a clerical error, not a terrorist event. So anyway, after moving here, I've been working with Salt Lake City since 2010 as the preparedness coordinator for the city. I think that's about it.
Thanks, John. My next guest on the panel, Clint Meekum. So Clint serves as the Emergency Management Director for Salt Lake County. He's also a battalion chief for the Unified Fire Authority, has spent many, many years in the business of firefighting. And I believe, Clint, you were a first responder to 9/11.
That's correct. Thanks, Jeff, and thanks everybody for being here. As Jeff said, my name is Clint Meekum. I am a battalion chief with Unified Fire. I've been with the fire department about 24 years. Got on the fire department shortly after graduating from the U. So, hey, it's good to be back at the alma mater. Served most of my career in the fire stations out in the Kearns area. So that's where I did most of my firefighting. I was also a hazardous materials specialist with the fire department before being promoted to captain and then on to battalion chief. I've currently been in my current position as the Salt Lake County Emergency Manager for about 6 years now. And we are responsible for the 16 cities, 5 metro townships, and unincorporated areas of Salt Lake County. At any given time, our responsibility includes about 80% of the, well, about two-thirds of the population of the state of Utah is in Salt Lake County at any given time, and we've got about 80% of the resources of the state. So in our small geographical area, we have a ton of things to worry about. So, and again, thanks for having me here.
Thanks, Clint. I'd like to next introduce Jana Wilkinson. Jana works for the state of Utah. She's a recovery and mitigation planner. She's going to talk a little bit about her role for the state and give us something a little bit unique about you.
Okay. So I guess, do you want just my role? Do you want my background?
Give us a little bit of both.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a small town in rural Utah. I left as soon as I could. Moved back east to Boston. I had my undergrad in social work, and after living and working there for 7 years, I ended up moving to London to get a master's in hazards and disaster management. I did that. I was working a lot, volunteering a lot in Haiti. I spent a lot of years working there, and the earthquake that happened had a great impact on me. A lot of nonprofits and others I was personally involved with were greatly impacted by the earthquake. And so that kind of put me on the path to looking at my master's in hazards and disasters. I was looking at public health and some other options, but that kind of steered me that way. I have pretty much traveled, spent time, and done projects in most countries around the world. I have not been to South America or Antarctica. But other than that, I've spent a lot of time in other places with a lot of other cultures, with a lot of working with a lot of people living in poverty in other countries. I came back to Utah. About 4 years ago, and started working with the state of Utah as their mitigation and recovery specialist. So I work in the mitigation and recovery department of the state. So we have several sections, as we call them. We have a preparedness section. So they're the ones that Be Ready Utah. Don't know if you guys have heard of them. They're the ones that go out a lot and work with locals and communities and schools on, you know, preparing for different events, getting your 72-hour kits together, drop covering and holding on during earthquakes. They do a lot of public education. We have our operations and logistics who work in our response section. They're the ones that deal a lot with a lot of what these guys do. And I guess a lot of what the questions are about is, you know, responding to an event, going out and saving people and saving buildings and working in the intense moments of the event. And I do mitigation and recovery. So we say we're kind of the sandwich ends. We do the preparedness before and after. Mitigation, our preparedness is, yes, 72-hour kits and stuff like that are mitigation, but we work a lot more with large grants for communities. So I manage currently about 65 grants from FEMA for locals, where we do pre-disaster mitigation grants. So FEMA does provide funding for communities to implement projects such as retention basins, detention ponds for flooding, retrofitting buildings for earthquakes, river restoration. So they can get funding to do projects like that to help protect the community and reduce the risks and reduce the impacts of those disasters. I also handle post-event grants, so I work a lot in recovery. So when we have events here, FEMA will come in and provide two types of service. So FEMA provides public assistance, which is grants that help community rebuild their infrastructure, and then individual assistance. And I'm going to put this in here because I might bring it up a little bit later because I think it's one of the very often overlooked public education pieces that we have, is that individual assistance with FEMA does not come in and replace or rebuild homes. Individual assistance is meant to provide immediate life safety, sustainable things to help you get through until you can figure out how to recover yourself. So they will come in and help provide interim housing. They'll help pay for rentals. They'll help put people up in hotels. They'll help pay for feeding. And sometimes you can get some money for repairs for your home, but it's minimal funding to help make your home safe, sanitary, and secure. So it's for boarding up windows. It's for putting light bulbs in when they're broken. It's not for repairing cabinets or replacing furniture or those items. And it's unfortunately, in a lot of the work I do, when I go out and talk to communities and individuals about how they're preparing for the disaster, most people do not prepare financially. They think, well, and even when I refinanced my home this last year, and in talking to my mortgage broker, I said, well, what is the mortgage company going to do if we have this earthquake and no one had insurance? Because homeowners insurance does not cover flood or earthquake damage. You have to have separate policies for those. And he said, well, FEMA will just come in. And I just laughed and shook my head. And I said, FEMA will not be coming in. Most individuals, when their homes are completely damaged, you end up taking out SBA loans, which is basically a second mortgage to repair your home, or people file bankruptcy and walk away. And so that's a lot of what I work with. I'm the person that after an event happens in Utah and it's not a federally declared disaster, or even if it is, we don't get the individual assistance funding. People call me and I have to tell them, I'm sorry, there is nothing I can do, and give them numbers for nonprofits to help them with their homes. So that's what I do in peace times. I also have deployed several times. I went to Florida. I don't go during the action. I usually end up going several months, weeks or months later, to follow up on the long term after the news crews have left and they're trying to rebuild and figure out what's going on. So I went to Alaska for a month last March after their earthquake, to work with their individual assistance program there. I've spent a couple weeks in Florida down in the Keys and in the Panhandle after the hurricanes 2 years ago. We had a flooding in Utah in spring of 2017, and I'm the head recovery person for that flooding, so I'm currently working on a lot of those projects here. Hopefully, I will be going to Puerto Rico in the spring as well. So that's a little bit of my background. Things go on. If you want one interesting thing?
I do.
I have a cat that is more like a dog, and she goes hiking with me. So.
Okay. All right. That's great. So we've got a great panel, lots of experience. When Jana was talking about recovery and the aspects that go into that process, the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake just closed a year ago? A year? So
Katrina's still open.
Katrina is still open. Loma Prieta went over 20 years. That's how long, right, this recovery process works. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So let's talk a little bit now about response. Presidential directive requires the federal government to have a plan for how they're going to respond to disaster. And they have a suite of frameworks, right? And that suite of frameworks will cover things like prevention and protection, mitigation, response, and recovery. So today we're touching on response, a little bit of mitigation and recovery. But there's also the prevention piece, which is kind of the terrorism response to events inside the country. And then, of course, the preparedness that we'll talk about. And it's really a whole community effort, right? Everybody has to take their role. You as an individual, each city, each county, each state, and, of course, the federal government based on the national response framework. That framework breaks down roles and responsibilities for each of the organizations within the federal government, and they have specific objectives that they are responsible for. And so when a state is contacting the federal government for a response, each organization, as it works its way down to the locals, knows who to contact within those respective emergency support functions, as they're called. So we won't get into a lot of detail about that framework because you can read up on it and get a lot of information from that. But what I really want to get into now at this point is start talking about the different levels of government, what their roles and responsibilities are, and work that through each one of those levels. And John, I think we'll start with you on the city level. All disasters are local. So the way I understand it, if something happens in Salt Lake City, you own it.
Yeah, you're all that.
yeah, so as Jeff said, I mean, every no matter what it is, what type of disaster, what's going on, everything is local, meaning that, and actually even the National Incident Management System, the Incident Command System, all of those command and control functions, they operate off of the ideology that everything is handled at the lowest possible level before it moves up to the next. So obviously within Salt Lake City, we are the lowest geopolitical jurisdictional authority. But even in Salt Lake City, it goes beyond that simply because just like Salt Lake City, it's broken further down into different community council areas or school neighborhood areas and things like that. So what we've tried to do is the approach we take is, especially on the preparedness and prevention side, one of our main goals is to try to reach down to that granular neighborhood level and even down as far as the household level. As Jen was saying, everything starts out at home. I mean, you can't get more local than inside your own house. So, and that's where we really try to push, statewide. The state of Utah is really, one of the reasons I actually ended up moving here, wanted to move here, was state of Utah is one of the most preparedness-minded states in the nation, which is really good. However, and I'm probably going to loop back around to this. Well, I'm going to save this for when we get into some other questions, but I'm going to bring this out as far as some of the biggest problems or greatest threats. Because what I say about that may surprise you, it may not. But anyway, so we really push, obviously, the personal preparedness, because everything starts there. And because if you're not sure that you're okay or your family's okay, and I preach this to our first responders all the time, our policemen, our firemen, everyone else. If you don't know that you are okay and your family's okay, what's the likelihood that you're going to be able to concentrate on doing your job? I mean, it literally is that granular. But then obviously we have to coordinate politically with the county, because they're our next step up, and then the county, then with the state. But we have some really unique geopolitical situations, obviously, because just like the U of U, it technically is in the boundaries of Salt Lake City. Places like the Salt Palace, it's in Salt Lake City, but it's owned by Salt Lake County, which is then again managed by a third party property manager who then again leases it out to fourth party vendors. So the legalities and the liabilities of issues like that, we have to make sure that we have what are called MOUs, Memorandums of Understanding, or MOAs, Memorandums of Agreement, and how certain things that involve certain properties or ownerships or buildings or however those things are handled when a disaster or an emergency strikes. And that's some of probably what we focus most on right now. And Jeff, stop me if I get ahead, because do we want to wait until...
Yeah,
there's some things that I was going to bring up about...
Yeah, you're going to talk a little bit about safe neighborhoods, right?
That, and then some of the other as far as infrastructure stuff does with our public utilities,
yeah,
things in the airport.
So I think let's move on to the county's responsibility, and
okay,
we're going to come back to that.
Okay.
So, Chief, we've talked about that granular piece, right, for local communities. You talked a little bit about sort of your regional responsibilities. What does that mean? What resources do you provide? How does that interface? What do communities have to do to engage your resources?
Sure. So as Jeff indicated, and as John indicated, Salt Lake County is the next tier up in that as we move up the progression from that very granular level to a more regional level. And as I stated earlier, in Salt Lake County, we have 16 municipalities, 5 metro townships, and then the unincorporated county. So in the unincorporated county, we have the responsibility at that granular level, like a city does, to deal with our citizens at a household by household basis. As you step into the next, that tier of municipalities and metro townships, our job is to make sure that everybody is on a level playing field. For example, the smallest community we have in this county is currently Alta. They've got about 328 people living in Alta, okay, full-time residents. Our largest city is Salt Lake City, and you guys have...
Daytime population,
yeah,
roughly 300,000.
Yeah. Okay, and we have everything in between, all right?
No, that's nighttime.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounded a little light. Anyway,
light.
Yeah, anyway. So we have to make sure that everybody at all levels has the same availability and the same access to resources and help and assistance that everybody else does. So Alta gets the same treatment as Bluffdale gets, as Salt Lake City gets, as West Valley gets, so on and so forth. part of the way we do that is Salt Lake County is unique in that we provide regional services. The health department for Salt Lake City is actually Salt Lake County Health, okay? Salt Lake County Public Works serves a lot of the public works functions for a lot of the municipalities by contract. So there's a lot of service-oriented assets available to our cities. Our job is to coordinate those in the time of an event or a disaster and make sure that the resources are going where they're most needed. It might be in the event of a catastrophic earthquake, the avenues are going to be one of the areas that are probably the most heavily affected by the earthquake, okay? But there are also areas out in West Valley that have the same kinds of issues that the avenues do as far as construction, shake, all that good kind of thing. We need to make sure that the resources get to where they're most needed. We do that by coordinating with our individual cities. So it might be that Harriman, for example, is less likely to suffer severe damage in our county, but they have resources available that we can co-opt from them and reallocate into West Valley or Salt Lake City, okay? We can reach laterally out to our other county partners within our region, and within the Salt Lake County region, our regional partners are Utah County to the south of us, Wasatch and Summit counties to the east of us, and then Tooele County to the west of us. Depending on what resources they have available, we can reach out horizontally, and see what additional resources we can gather from them. In the event that we exhaust all of those resources, then we make a declaration and we reach up to the state and ask them for additional help. And then the state can reach up to the feds as well. But again, the responsibility for us is being able to catch or receive all of those assets and resources as they come in. One of the things that we've found in large-scale disasters, again, looking at like a Katrina or a Rita, most city level or municipal governments have a hard time maintaining cohesion. And a parish or a county is normally the lowest level of government that maintains cohesion during a disaster. So we've got to be able to function at that by the ability of catching those resources coming in and then making sure that we're functioning as that regional government to get them where they're needed in the event that the cities are not in a position to do everything that they need to do. So in a nutshell, without getting just absolutely boring about it, right? That's kind of where we sit at the county level.
That was Clint Meekum, Emergency Manager for Salt Lake County. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today, local emergency experts discuss what happens in case of a natural disaster in Utah, what resources will be available, and best practices to keep yourself and others safe. Here again is moderator Jeff Gravett, Director of the University of Utah Emergency Management Services.
So Chief Meekum spoke about a really important piece of this disaster response process, and that is making that formal declaration to the next level of government. So in order to engage those resources, it's a verbal conversation initially, but it has to follow up with a process. And that process works its way all the way up to the state of Utah. And they're kind of our trigger point. They're the team that gets the wheel going, and they are the GAR, okay? The governor's authorized representative. Jana, can you talk a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, so as they mentioned on the local level, so there's a saying, and it came from FEMA. I believe it was Brock Long, but I can't remember right now. So it might have been another director before him. But it really summarizes up kind of how the system works. So it says, disasters are locally executed, state managed, and federally supported. So when you're thinking about how that goes, that's kind of where it goes. All the action happens at the local level. A lot of management and middleman. We at the state are the middleman. We have to volley back and forth between locals and federal agencies. I'll get to a little bit of that later, but when the declaration comes up, it's a very formal process. And unfortunately, we are in Utah where we get along really well. We have a lot of small communities that, you know, my grandfather's cousin is the lieutenant governor, so I have an inside if I want to go talk to him. But in disasters, it can be a very formal process. FEMA has thresholds. If you're going for federal funding, there's thresholds set for the state and there's thresholds set for each county. Because it's expected that you, and it's based off population and a bunch of other things like that, but it's expected that you as a county or you as a state should be able to handle the disaster up to a certain dollar amount. You should have the resources to handle it to that. For the state right now, it's just over $4 million. So we would have to have $4 million in damages to public infrastructure. That does not count for individual homeowners or private property. For individual assistance, that's a separate evaluation criteria. But to get a federal disaster for public assistance, it's just over $4 million for the state. And that's uninsured public infrastructure that's damaged. Counties all have different thresholds. I don't remember what Salt Lake's is off the top of my head.
3.54.
So yeah, most of our 4 million comes from Salt Lake. We do have smaller counties. I know Carbon's a couple years ago was right around 74,000. Unfortunately, Carbon has had disasters up in the $1 and $2 million of damages, but because it did not reach the state level, we could not get a federal declared disaster for that county. So you can see, unfortunately, kind of the impacts of that. Up until this last year, we didn't have state funding to help with disaster recovery. We do have a state restricted account that will help with state services such as Army Corps. If UDOT, Department of Transportation, or any other state service comes out and helps, we have a restricted account that we can get permission from the legislature to then reimburse those agencies for their services during response phases. Fortunately, this last year, my boss, Brad Lortham, you really worked a lot with some of the legislators, and we requested a couple million. We ended up getting $300,000. But we have $300,000 for recovery and response efforts to help locals. We're hoping that when we wipe that out a couple times, they'll realize we need a lot more money than that set aside. We are fortunate in Utah that we do not have a lot of large disasters. And so the unfortunate side of that fortunate is it doesn't become prevalent in our locals, in the publics, and in the lawmakers' minds. And so it's really hard to get people to realize what the threat is when they don't see it all the time or they haven't experienced it. So formal process, locals go to the county. County then comes to us. They have to write a formal declaration and send it into us. Fortunately, we have templates we will send out. They do have to keep track and calculate and tally the damages that are happening. In order for us to know if we can go to the federal level, we have to have some sort of guesstimate of how much damage is going on because of the disaster. It can be really difficult when a lot of local communities don't have the staffing or they don't have the practices in place to track those type of things. A lot of our rural communities, it's pretty casual. The guy just goes out and fixes it because that's what he does, and they don't track their resources. So it can be difficult at the county or even the city level when resources aren't tracked, but there's a lot of documentation that goes into disasters. Keeping track of who's doing what and where, tracking volunteers, tracking all of that. They submit that to us. We will be bugging them as the disaster's going on if they want us to go to the federal level. We need data to know if we can. We at the state will get that data, get the declaration, do the calculations, ask some questions, and see if it's something that can go up to a federal level. If it is, then what happens is our department will write the declaration, which then goes to the governor's office. They review and approve it, and the governor will sign a state declaration, either of emergency or of disaster. And then we will then send that with all the documentation the local communities have sent us to FEMA, requesting a federal declaration. FEMA, they have regions, so our region is Region 8, they're based in Denver. They review all of the data, and then they will send it to the president with a recommendation either to or to not declare. So the president and FEMA is kind of like the governor to us. When we say governor's authorized representative, is that the governor signs his name to everything, and he has to make the final decision, but we do a lot of the research, the work, the writing, and the reviewing. So that's the process. It does have to go through that. We do get some communities that will want to call like I said, if you have an in to the governor or your local legislature and you call them and say, there's a lot going on and no one's helping us and we want help, puts a kink in things because you are required to go through the official channels if you want reimbursement for the disasters that are happening or for things to be authorized. National Guard is very expensive, so you really don't want them to come out and be doing things that they're not, don't necessarily need them to do. If we get a federal declaration, the state works as kind of the mediator and the manager for FEMA coming out. FEMA will come out and then do in-person reviews of the damages that happened and start issuing grants to help with those recovery processes. Those can be, like we said, to help rebuild infrastructure. They also have grants for things like unemployment, helping with housing, or any of those other issues that we have. FEMA will review it, then authorize the funding. And then what happens is FEMA leaves, sends all of the funding to the state. The state holds the funding in an account, and then we pay out the pre-approved grants to the locals as they do their repairs. Once FEMA leaves after the disaster, the state manages all that happens with disaster grants and recovery or response reimbursements after that. And we're basically the go-between between locals and the federals. So.
Okay, Jana, thank you. So we've talked a lot about how this process of response works and kind of the intricacies of connecting all the dots. But in order for this to happen, we have to have good plans. And it's really not so much about the plan as much as it is about the planning process, right? That's how people get educated and learn how they're going to respond to whatever the disaster is. So most of our communities, well, I think all of our communities here in the state of Utah really work off of this all hazards type of planning approach. But one of the things that we have to do when we're doing that is we have to analyze our risks and threats, right? What hazards can we anticipate? There's not a lot of reason to plan for a hurricane here in the state of Utah, right? But it makes a lot of sense to plan for an earthquake.
Yeah.
If we get a hurricane, it's not good. There are other problems, right? So the University of Utah, as a matter of fact, I'm going in front of President Watkins in 2 weeks to promulgate our updated emergency operations plan. And one of the things that we looked at was our risk and hazards. And the two big risks that come out for the university, well, three, are, of course, earthquake, because we live right here on the fault. One cuts right through the middle of campus. The second one is active shooter and violent event, because that is now happening across our country at extreme numbers, right? And then lastly, severe weather. We get a lot of that here, and it has a great impact on what happens on campus. I don't know how many of you were here last year for school, but we canceled classes because we had a major snowstorm, right? And that impacts how we do business here on campus. So we have other things that we plan for. Jana, is that different from how the state plans, or are there other threats or hazards that the state of Utah has that we're not looking at?
So I will tell all of you, if you want to look at our hazard mitigation plan, we just updated it. We updated it every 5 years, and we made it a website so that you can navigate, find the highlights, and not have to read this really thick, horrible, massive book of a document, page by page PDF. It's hazards.utah.gov. Very easy to find and remember. So if you want to look at the ones that the state analyzes, so we have to look at everything. FEMA has some requirements for lovely issues like space weather. We do include looking at hurricanes and stuff like that, and then we prioritize what's actually a threat and the level of threat in there. So a lot of things are listed, but not in depth. A lot of what we at the state as a whole look at is, and we get asked this a lot, what's our biggest risk? What's our biggest hazard? And obviously the earthquake would be the most catastrophic event. That would be one that would cause a lot of damage, a lot of deaths, and a lot of chaos. I'm currently working with the state on an ongoing basis on I'm the coordinator for our long-term recovery for a catastrophic earthquake event plan. So we have that plan, which involves a lot of state agencies. We also have the state's mitigation plan that we work on. But what we look at is earthquakes the most catastrophic, but the most frequent, the most often, and the most likely are wildfire and floods. That's what we deal with a lot at the state. It's a lot of the events that we respond to are the wildfire and flood hazards. And as you've seen what's been going on in California, almost on a yearly basis now, it gets worse every year, and Utah is growing rapidly, and we're building a lot into the foothills, spreading a lot. And unfortunately, Utah, as far as flood maps, the mandated flood maps from the federal government where there are detailed studies about flood risk, Utah's like, I think it's like less than 10% officially mapped, because we've been so rural for so long that there's just approximate zones. And a lot of those communities are building without detailed studies of those hazards, and there's a demand for us to build quickly. So we're going to see a lot more of that flooding, fire. We have a lot of communities that are on flood watches now because of the fires we've had the last few years that have gotten close to communities. And flooding increases after wildfires. So they kind of go hand in hand. Those are what we deal with the most. And then there's also the site events. We have lots of trains that come through Utah. We have a lot of those things, tankers. So we deal with those at the state, we haven't had to do too many resources. Private companies have a lot that they do to handle those things themselves, but we do get involved on occasion with train derailments or tanker spills or things like that. Algal blooms are another thing that are becoming quite prevalent every summer. It's a new thing we're dealing with. It wasn't previously in our hazard identification, but it's a new one that we've added in. So,
thanks, Jana.
That was Jana Wilkinson, Recovery and Mitigation Planner for the Utah Division of Emergency Management. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Once again, here is Jeff Gravitt, Director of the University of Utah Emergency Management Services and moderator of this discussion.
So when we talk now about preparedness, here on campus, that's been kind of a unique sort of rethink for the emergency management team, because we're not going to ask students to walk around with 72-hour kits and their books and their computers and everything else that they have to have on campus, but we want them to have some kind of capability. And so we came up with our plan that we asked students to have 16 ounces of water, because you're always carrying a water bottle, top it off all the time, and 1,200 calories of food, so that that buys us a little bit of time to either get you off campus or get you to some safe zone or get you back home. Pretty simple plan, pretty basic, but it's supplies that you can take care of yourself for just a minute until we can rally resources to help take care of you. John, what else should we be doing in emergencies?
Well, and if you look over, say, just even the last two decades, whether it's earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, and you start looking, and I know everyone in here is heard of, obviously, of putting together a 72-hour kit. But that's a little bit of a misnomer, because if you look at all the after-action reviews, the after-action reports, the improvement plans of every major disaster that's happened nationwide over the last couple of decades, and you look at how from when the disaster happened to when those outside resources start actually getting to where they need to be, because even at that, just like here, when earthquake happens, there are like EMAC agreement. Do you guys know what EMAC is? It's Emergency Management Assistance Compact. It's sort of like a, and Jen, you can kind of speak to this maybe a little bit later, but it's sort of like almost an intermediary step between that official disaster declaration that goes up to the president, and in that it's an agreement between states, surrounding states, that have agreements to send resources for certain types of events. But even though that those outside resources are going to start responding pretty much immediately after the ground stops shaking, it takes time for those resources to get from where they're going to where they're to get here. And then even after they get here, there has to be a place for them to set up bases of operation. There has to be route clearances and things like that. And even at that, you look at just the population of Salt Lake City, because like I said, the live-in population here is roughly 300,000. The daytime population can go up to, you know, 500,000 or more, depending on, say, if it's LDS General Conference, or say if there's a jazz game or some sort of other football game here, big event. Those numbers dramatically fluctuate. So one of the things that, as I started mentioning earlier, the whole personal preparedness obviously is where everything starts. But when I moved here from Arkansas, again, coming from where I came from, and one of the last big boots on the ground operations that I was involved in was Hurricane Katrina. And without getting into any politics or finger pointing or anything like that, disasters are, the definition of a disaster in and of itself is the fact that it's an event that the local jurisdictions aren't able to deal with. They don't have the resources. They don't have the manpower. But the fact is it wouldn't matter the number of resources we had when a disaster happens. When you're in the area where a disaster happens, it takes time for even the first responders to get their arms around it and start dealing with it. One of the prime examples is April 8th of 2008. In Arkansas, we had a F4 tornado come through, and I happened to be on duty, and my duty station was the heavy rescue station. And it was one of those situations where, well, the tornado came over, and luckily it didn't wasn't a direct hit on our fire station, but it pushed in the bay doors to the point that we could not get the doors open. We actually had to take the cabling from the heavy rescue and run over the purlings of the building to pull the doors open to actually get out and respond. And where I'm going with this is, what I'm saying is, even though resources start to respond immediately, they can't get to everyone at the same time. So there had to be one of the things about not just the state of Utah, but specifically here with the earthquake scenario. When I went to work for Salt Lake City in 2010, we had the first Great Utah Shakeout. It was at 2011 or 2012. One of those two. I can't remember. I think it was 2012. But one of the things that we have been lacking, not just here but across the nation in emergency response, is that gap between when the time that disaster happens, whether it's earthquake, tornado, whatever, and when those outside resources start getting here. And then among other things, especially when you're looking at tornadoes, hurricanes, and earthquakes, the whole family reunification piece, getting around transportation corridors, that sort of thing, are dramatically affected, compromised. And so shortly after we had the first shakeout here, and I sat down and started looking at all of the things that went wrong with Hurricane Katrina and all the things that we were still looking at here as far as those gaps, and how many people in here has anybody in here heard of the Safe Neighborhoods program?
One, two, three, four.
Okay, this is one of the biggest problems. See, talking about major threats, it's not as much the disaster itself as the lack of public knowledge about things that we may have in place. Compounded by, and this is the clincher here, either apathy or willful ignorance among the general public. and I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm just saying, because it's how many people if you're from here, have been hearing about the earthquake scenario your entire life, but it's never happened. And so that lulls people into that false sense of, yeah, it's never going to happen, whatever. I mean, because quite honestly, last time an earthquake of any magnitude happened here, there were pronghorns, sheep and, you know, antelope, some buffalo and some Native American tribes. And I mean, because it was 350 plus years ago, last time a major earthquake happened here. So in looking at that, and the good thing is a lot of disasters happen here. The bad thing is the fact that they don't, as Jen was referring to, it's not in the forefront of people's minds. It's this nebulous concept. So anyway, this is a long way of getting around to coming up with the Safe Neighborhoods program. It was to help address on that granular level, from the household to your neighborhood to within each municipality, as we're getting those resources in. So we've started, started the whole concept of, instead of 72-hour kit, a 96-hour kit, simply because looking at those disasters, it's at least 4 days, and we want people to be as prepared as possible. I mean, we suggest, yeah, it's a good idea to have 2 weeks worth of food, whatever, in your house. Of course it is. But you need a way that you need a kit that you can grab and be mobile at a moment's notice. Now, granted, I know everyone's not, you know, I mean, considering where I grew up, I'm one of those weird prepper people, which really makes me good at my job. Not that I have a bunker out in the West Desert somewhere. But the idea is that you need to be prepared to make sure that you and your family and your neighbors can take care of one another for that extended period of time. And the Safe Neighborhoods program was one of those. The idea and the concept for the program was mine, but I can tell you, especially including specifically Clint, Jeff, Jenna, people at the county, state level, individual community members, I could probably rattle off a list of at least 200 individual names that went into making this program what it is and actually being able to implement it and make it a success. But the idea behind the program and the tagline for the program is a little bit of a misnomer, but it's grab your kit, walk to school. And the idea is that when the earthquake happens here, no matter where you are in Salt Lake County, because the program's been adopted countywide now, that you get to your closest elementary school, and that's going to be your fastest way to get where you need to go as far as family reunification. And it took a lot of coordination, because when you look at all the moving pieces, you're talking about transportation, you're talking about school districts, you're talking about streets departments and all of these. So there was a lot of thought into how this would be coordinated and work with the overall response plan. But the idea is that now in every public elementary school in Salt Lake County, there's what's called a just-in-time earthquake kit. And essentially what I did is I took our professional command and control structure, the incident command system, broke it down into layman's terms with simple 1 to 2 page checklist for everything that neighborhood is going to need to do, from setting up a reunification center, setting up shelters, doing their own search and rescue operations, everything they're going to need to do to get themselves by, coordinating resources within that individual neighborhood until we can start getting those outside resources in. And one of the biggest pieces, I'm going to put a question to you guys. You guys are going to get to ask us questions. What would probably be the one of the most critical factors in being able to respond to an emergency? What do you need to be able to respond to an emergency? And I'm not talking about equipment. Communication. If you can't communicate, you can't coordinate. If you can't coordinate, you can't respond. So when this happens, if you're looking at our situation here in the Salt Lake Valley with earthquake scenario, what's going to happen to our communications capabilities? What's going to happen to electricity, internet, all the things that we rely on to be able to communicate that we take for granted on a day-to-day basis? We're not going to have that luxury anymore. One of the pieces that's built into the Safe Neighborhoods program, and again, this is where it comes back down to the personal preparedness, and not just for making sure you have food and supplies in your home, but educating yourself, taking training, whether it's, you guys know what CERT is, the Community Emergency Response Team program, or classes with the Red Cross, or get licensed as an amateur radio operator. Because quite honestly, and again, where I come from, I grew up on a rural farming community, population 2,500. I mean, literally, even the time I graduated high school, there was still only one traffic light in town. I mean, and we live 25 miles east of Little Rock, which is the most populous area in the state, and those of you who don't know, in the South, tornadoes move from west to east. Don't care where you are, that's the way they move. And being east of Little Rock, which is the most populated area, where do you think FEMA, Red Cross, all those other entities, do you think they went to my little small farming town? No, they went to the most populated area, because the whole philosophy of what we do is you do the greatest good for the greatest number of people possible. So we learned very quickly that it was essentially neighbor helping neighbor. And there was no written plan, no written policy. That's just the way we grew up, and it was part of the culture. But that philosophy is what I worked into this Safe Neighborhoods program. And in Salt Lake City, it was broken down by elementary school neighborhood areas, because each one of those areas has a population density of roughly 5,000 to 7,000 people, small, manageable areas. And you can't hardly throw a rock, at least in Salt Lake City proper, without hitting an elementary school. But the idea is that those schools are going to be used as hubs for family reunification, transportation, those sorts of things. And to be able to gather that information, the idea is that we're going to have amateur radio operators from each one of those neighborhoods to help be that relaying that information from those neighborhoods directly to us at the Emergency Operations Center. So we can start taking that information as they calculate number of people trapped, number of people injured, number of resources they need, or what's going on in that neighborhood. It creates an avenue for them to create that communication, one-way, two-way communication directly to the Emergency Operations Center at each municipal level. So then as we start populating that information on our maps, we gather that information and pass it on to the county and then on up to the state. Yeah.
So, John, I was just going to say, is there a website for Safe Neighborhoods?
Thank you. Yes, there is. It's safeutah.org. And then if you live in Salt Lake City, we've kind of started updating our city website. It's safeslc.com, because in each one of those kits, and I'll let Clint talk a little bit more about on the county level, but no matter where you're at, every one of those kits in each one of those schools has an area map of that neighborhood broken down by search grid, block numbers, information where you can collect that information, so then give it to the radio operators to relay it right to us. So, and this kind of comes back into what Jen was saying about documentation. FEMA has a schedule of man hours, types of things done, and what dollar amounts those relate to. And so that allows us, it's a built-in mechanism to make it more of a seamless transition into that local neighborhood response up to the official city and county and state response. Were you going to say something? In those kits, it allows this is all based on the preparation of each individual neighborhood, which is why I encourage people to go to a Safe Neighborhoods training and learn more about the program, go to the websites, get the details, because the more of that documentation and information that we collect, we can use those man hours and things as match against that federal disaster declaration. And back to Clint's point, Salt Lake County, would you said it's 3.54 million? Salt Lake City alone roughly accounts for about 2 million of that 3.54 million. So the more information and documentation that we can collect, not only does it help on the financial end, it also helps to seamlessly tie in response information from each one of those neighborhoods to us, because then we, as we get that information in, we can start to see where we can send what resources that we have, where it needs to go first. And that's where the communication and coordination piece comes in.
Thanks, John. So we have just a few minutes left. Jana, did you have a quick comment?
Very quick comment. Just your thing of what you can do here at the university. I was a university student. I laughed at 2 weeks of prepared food because I could barely think about or store what I was going to eat tomorrow, let alone store 2 weeks worth of canned goods in a dorm room when I was moving every semester. So I would just say you guys are going to want to, like you said, it can take a long time for things to happen. Things can move slowly. The school might be shut down for a while. I know there's negotiations between the university and the state about, can we take over the university or the dorms for locals for housing if we're short on housing stock? I would just look at things, making sure you have a communication plan with your family so that they do know how to get a hold of you, or you know how to get a hold of them afterwards. Phones will be jammed. Texting is a much better way to do it. I would say store phone numbers online somewhere. So if your phone is lost or broken, you can still find your parents' phone numbers because nobody memorizes phone numbers anymore.
Jot them down on a piece of paper, right?
Well,
And pencil still work.
Save them on Google Drive because you can get it anywhere. You can access phone numbers as long as you find internet somewhere, borrow someone else's phone, you can find your parents' phone number. And then I would just make sure you know where the university is storing food and water on campus, where they want you to go if something happens. And also look at financial stuff. If you're not living on campus, look at renter's insurance. It's not that expensive. You can get it for floods and earthquakes, for just your contents in your dorm room or in your apartments. And so those are just some things to look at. So on to the
On behalf of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, I want to thank our panel for spending an hour with us. Really appreciate your input and your comments. Thank you for attending, and we'll look forward maybe to another opportunity.
If you'd like to hear the full forum or listen to another Hinckley forum, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute podcast. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.